Good evening, everybody. Thank you all for being here tonight. I think there's quite a few newcomers. Is that right? Raise your hand if this is your first night here. So a lot of students for classes and some people just heard about this course. A lot of our regulars probably lost the rhythm of coming because we had three classes and then missed last week because of a special holy day event here. And I expect that a lot of people just got out of the rhythm of coming, so probably forgot that it was Tuesday night, which is probably what I would do. But welcome, everybody. Thank you all for being here. And for those of you who are here for the first time, this is the fourth out of five classes, and so there may be some things that might feel a little confusing to you. You might be a little lost, depending on whatever background you might have in Buddhism. If you have no background at all, there may be some things that confuse you. If you've done some reading and have the basics, you probably can catch up pretty well. But I will be here after class if there's something that's really bothering you that you haven't understood. So my name is Elise Strievel. I am the outreach coordinator here at Kadampa Center, so you can reach me at outreach@kadampacenter.org if you have any questions. And if you forget this email address, you could just go to our website, look under the management team, and you'll see me there, and you can connect with me in that way. I've been coming here to Kadampa Center since 2004, and I'm still a baby Buddhist, but I really feel like it's nourished my life to be introduced to these teachings, and I work diligently at maintaining the learning and coming to teaching. So I hope that all that I share with you is as accurate as I can make it. And if there's any misleading involved, it's my own error and not that of the teachings. So we always start out with an intention for the night. So our intention tonight, we've all could be anywhere else in the world or anywhere else, but we all made the effort to think about coming, to decide to come, to making the effort to come and to be here. So there must be something that you need, that you hope for, in making your effort to be here tonight. So my intention is that when you leave here, you will have found at least some little nugget that is helpful to you to make your mind and heart a little more peaceful and a little more wise. Okay, so we will start with a little bit of meditation review. There are different kinds of meditation. Okay, to review what we've learned, meditation in Buddhism is not just sitting and trying to empty your mind. We do not believe, it's not possible to think about nothing. But the word meditation comes from the Tibetan word gom, G-O-M, which means to become familiar with. So our intention in meditation is to become familiar with our own minds. First, to become familiar with how to tame our minds, to control our minds so our mind is not controlling us. And then to expose ourselves to teachings through reading, through listening, through conversation with our teachers. And then to use our meditation time to become familiar with those ideas and to apply them to our lives. So the first step, of course, is being able to put yourself in a position in which you can do that. And it's important for your body to be comfortable and so that your mind can then be comfortable and focus. So there's a very specific meditation posture, and the reason for this posture is so that if you train yourself to be in this position, you will find that you will be able to sit quietly and have your body be peaceful for longer periods of time so that your mind can then do what you want it to do. It might be uncomfortable to us Westerners at first, but slowly, slowly, no, nothing happens overnight. It may take you weeks, months, a year or two to get your body to want to be in this posture, but it is really worth it in the end. The first thing that's important is to be sure that if you are sitting in a chair, that your feet are flat on the floor comfortably. For those of you with short legs like myself, you might need to put your feet on a cushion. And most commonly, there's the sitting with your legs folded. Whether you are sitting in a chair or sitting with your legs folded, it's important to try and have your hips slightly elevated. If you're sitting in a chair, it's better not to have like a Barca lounger. It's better to have a firm, flat chair. And for you to be able to sit up straight without your back leaning against the back of the chair. And that's really hard to do without a little bit of support under your hips. I can't even do it in this chair. Western chairs are not made for good posture. They make your whole body lazy by supporting it in a bad posture. By sitting up with your hips elevated, your spine can stack itself. Your skeleton is made to support you if you are in the proper posture, a straight posture. And that is why it's important to try to sit with your back straight, so legs, feet or legs supported, your hips slightly elevated so your spine can be nice and straight and supporting itself. You want in Tibetan Buddhism, we put our right hand cupped into our left hand on the bottom, thumbs touching, down at the waist level, arms away from your body so air can circulate. The reason for having your hands this way, one reason is it represents a basket receiving the teachings. And it's just a comfortable way to keep your hands. Some people, or other styles, might have them resting on their lap or, you know, their knees. And that's fine, too. Whatever's comfortable. But just in our tradition, we do the cupped hands with the thumbs touching. Okay, then your head should be just very slightly tilted forward. Not too far forward because it would tumble over this way. Not too far backward because then it would fall backward. Hyper alert, hyper tired. Okay? So just very slightly forward. Your eyes lightly closed just to let in a little bit of light so that you don't want to fall asleep, but you're not distracted by looking around either. Your jaw should be comfortably closed, not tight clenched. Your tongue should be up the roof of your mouth behind your top teeth to keep your mouth from drying out. Okay, so then once you're in the posture, the first thing we want to do is to scan the body, just to bring yourself in. So you got on the car, you drove over here, you got here, got out of the car, walked in, took your seat. Your head is here on top of your shoulders. Your back is nice and straight. Feel yourself here in this space. Pull yourself in. You are here, sitting on a cushion or a chair. Pull yourself in. Next, we try to pull our mind together by counting very slowly, counting our breath. First, just take a few breaths. Listen to the air. Feel the air going in and out. Then start counting on the inhale for one and out. Inhale, two and out. And go to 10. So why do we count our breath? It helps us to focus. When you count on the inhale, you are forced to concentrate a little more than if you're counting on the exhale. Just try it sometime, experiment, and you'll see that to be true. Why do people say when you're angry to count to 10? What's the purpose for it? One reason is that it helps to bring your mind to a neutral place. When you count slowly, it brings your mind to a neutral place, and it's easier to get to a positive place from there. So now we'll talk about another kind of meditation that we reviewed, and that's the 9-round breathing. Geshe Gelug, our teacher, tells us we have thousands of energy channels running throughout our body, all through our body, all of the time. Every thought is a piece of energy that's running throughout our body all of the time. So what happens when we have a negative thought that kind of puts out some negative energy that blocks one of these channels? The result is that we have one of these thoughts that just won't go away. One of these, maybe we got angry at someone and we just keep thinking about it over and over and over again. We just can't get rid of it. It's just stuck in one of those channels. So how do we release that? One technique is the 9-round breathing. And to do this, take the ring finger of your left hand and you'll press closed your left nostril and breathe in through your right. Then put your finger on the other side and breathe out through the left. Block your left. In. Lock the right, out. One more time, block the left. Block the right. So that's 3. Then you take your right hand, the ring finger, block the right nostril, in through the left. Out through the right. Block the right. Block the left. Block the right. Block the left. So that makes 6. And for the last 3, you breathe fully in and out without blocking your nasal passages. In, out. In, out. In, out. That's called the 9-round breathing. So when you find yourself feeling stuck with some unwanted thought in your mind just going over and over and over and over, if you sit down and concentrate and do this practice, it might take you 2, 3, 4, maybe more times, but it's amazing how it can work. Give it a try. Okay, so now, once you've brought your body to this place, you've brought your mind to this place, you've helped to focus, you've unblocked the negativity from your channels. The next thing that you might want to do is what we call analytical meditation, which is really the point of meditation. The point of meditation is to be able to get familiar with a positive state of mind. As you learn more and more about Buddhism, if you choose to do that, it is the time that you would take one of the ideas that you've learned in a teaching and think about it. What does it mean? Is it really true? Is it really true for you? Have you seen the evidence for this teaching to be true? How does it apply to my life? And that's what you would do in analytical meditation. But what you can do as a beginner is to take something that happened to you that you may not understand and use your time to think about that. And one example might be, suppose you were in traffic earlier today. Somebody cut in front of you and boy, just made you angry. You think, hey, what about that situation? What emotions arose when that thing happened? Why did anger arise? What made me angry about it? Did I feel like this road is my road and I should be driving down it without any interference from anybody else? What makes me feel that I should have that feeling? Am I angry because I thought the other person was deliberately trying to do some harm to me? Does that person even know me? Is it possible that other person was having a bad day or trying to rush to an emergency? Why did these feelings arise? And how did it affect the situation by becoming angry? Did it improve the situation? Did it make me feel better to be angry? And if not, is this a feeling that I want? Probably not. So what can I do to avoid having that feeling when that situation comes up? Maybe I could first remember that I'm not the only one on this road, that I'm sharing this with others. Maybe I can try and have some compassion for the person who cut in front of me, even if they did it out of thoughtlessness. Or maybe what kind of a person does things like that? They must not have a very peaceful and happy life. I should have some sympathy and compassion for them. Or maybe they really did have an emergency. Maybe they were rushed to a hospital. Maybe there was some other emergency. Maybe I can think that way. So maybe the next time this happens to me, instead of immediately letting those feelings of anger come up, maybe I could stop, count to 10, get myself to that neutral place, and start having a more positive attitude toward that situation. So this is just an example of a way that you might use your time in meditation to take something in your life and learn how to deal with it more positively by getting more in touch with what emotions arise with different situations. And if you choose to come to teachings or read more about the Buddhist philosophy, maybe you can learn the definition of some terms that might help you to deal with these kinds of situations. Or if you choose to follow some different philosophy, maybe you can find some ideas in that other philosophy of choice to help you deal with those emotions as they arise, and to give you a way to control your mind and then to control your emotions, and so lead yourself to a more peaceful and happy place, one that's filled with compassion for yourself and for others. Are there any questions about meditation before we go on? All right. Thank you all for participating. Okay, so our plan for tonight, we had already talked about many of these things. We talked about karma in past lessons. We'll review that a little bit. We're going to talk about precious human rebirth, the Buddhist view of death. We will talk again about the 10 non-virtuous actions and ethical behavior and purification, the four opponent powers. And those are things we talked about a little bit in past classes. We'll talk about a little more tonight. And then we'll talk about some important terms and concepts in Buddhism. All right, so we'll start with karma. Now, especially those of you who are here for the first time, it's really very important for you to remember that many of these words, like karma and just many other things that we'll come across later, we use these words so many times, so many ways, they become part of the culture, but the definition that you might think of when you see this word like karma may not be the Buddhist definition. So it's very important that when we're talking about the Buddhist philosophy, that you are thinking of the definition used in this context. An example that I've given in past class is, when I say the word sharp, what comes to your mind? Some people might be thinking of a sharp knife. Some people might be thinking of look sharp, looking really good. Some people might be thinking of B flat, B sharp in music. So if you're talking about music and you use the definition sharp as being like a blade, it's going to be very confusing, right? So it's very important for you to have in your mind the definition that applies to the Buddhist philosophy and not what you heard in a song like Instant Karma's Gonna Get You or something like that, okay? So in Buddhism, karma means action or your energy. Every thought is a little bit of karma. It's a little piece of energy. And it's the working of cause and effect, whereby positive or virtuous actions produce happiness and negative or non-virtuous actions produce suffering. And actions can be a thought. Every thought is an action. So positive thoughts tend to promote more positive thoughts. Negative ones promote more negative ones. It's really important to always be keeping ourselves on track. And though we think of karma as something that we can see in a short time scale, like instant karma or karma that happens within days or months or years, Buddhism thinks about karma as something that happens over lifetimes. So, here is the connection between mind, rebirth, and karma. Okay, the basic principle in Buddhism is that everything has a cause. The mind is non-physical, so can only be produced by something that is non-physical, which means that every thought that you have had, because in Buddhism, your mind is everything in you that is not physical. It's not your brain. It's everything in you that is not physical. So everything that's in your mind came from the moment before, the moment before and before. So in the Buddhist philosophy, logically, before the moment of birth, your mind was there before and before and before. And after our physical death, our mind will be there again and again and again. Okay? Each moment of mind is produced by the previous moment of mind. This continuity of consciousness is the basis for the Buddhist belief in rebirth and karma. Now, this greatly differs from the belief that mind and body do not exist until they are made by a creator, and that our creation and subsequent life is not under our control or direction. According to karma, the life that we are in now, the moment that we are in at this very moment, was created by ourselves in the moment before and before and before. In some philosophies, your life begins when some creator made you. In the Buddhist philosophy, essentially, you made yourself. So, compare this to the view of, I didn't ask to be born, or why did this happen to me? According to the rule of karma, you not only asked to be born, you created yourself into this life. And everything that happens to you is a situation that you created for yourself. We have a teacher called, by the name of Venerable Rabina, who's an amazing teacher. She teaches internationally, and she'll actually be coming to Kadampa Center in March of 2016. So if you have a chance to come listen to her, I'd really recommend it. But she's done a lot of teachings here, and one of the things she said is that this view of I didn't ask to be born and why did this happen to me, she says this is a very good question, and the lack of an answer is what increases our suffering. The Buddhist view of karma is one way to answer this, but it's not the only way, but it is one way. So take it as a theory and test it out. You don't have to believe in previous or next lives to be able to try and test it out even in your own life. And think about, well, who am I today? And like, why am I a person in this particular school or class or job? What choices have I made to bring myself here? And you'll see that if you made different choices, you would probably very likely be in a different place. So just think of that cause and effect. Start with on a small scale. Take it as a theory to test it out. Everything in Buddhism is not only encouraged, it's required that you don't take anything just because somebody said it. These ideas have stood the test of thousands of years. They are the essence of the law of how things are. And in order to take any, to believe something, we encourage, require really, the faith of conviction that you think about these things, just stay on one thought until you feel convinced it's absolutely true and apply it to your life, or say, it's really not true, and put it aside. So, again, I repeat, Buddhism is all about thinking and testing out what you believe and why you believe it. It's a philosophy of mindfulness and action. Even for those ideas that you must rely on others' words and leadership, do not follow blindly. Check and confirm their ethics and actions. Venerable Rubina tells a story. It says, when you're a child and your mother tells you not to touch the stove because it's hot, and you don't touch the stove because she told you not to, it's okay as a child to not touch the hot stove because your mother told you not to. It's not appropriate to not touch a hot stove when you're an adult because somebody told you. By the time you're an adult, you should be not touching that stove because you know it is hot and it will cause you harm. Okay? So that's the thinking in Buddhism. You should be doing or not doing things because you understand why you are doing or not doing it. All right. So next we're going to talk about precious human rebirth. This is a very important idea in Buddhism. The fact that you were born a human being is a very rare and precious thing. It is said that having been born into a human form is the result of much, much positive merit in the past. Because think of all the bazillions of other sentient beings that there are. Everything from insects to animals, probably beings on other planets, and of all those bazillions of other forms of sentient beings you could have been, you have the privilege of being born in a human life. And why is it so important? It's considered very rare and difficult to obtain. There's a whole story in the Tibetan story where it's as rare to get a human rebirth as if there was a turtle in the ocean and it comes to the surface once every 500 years. And there's an ox yoke floating in the ocean. And the chance of that turtle coming up once every 500 years and getting its neck through the yoke is the chance of your finding a human rebirth. So it's very important to recognize how precious your life is and to resolve not to waste it. As a human, you have an ideal balance of leisure and suffering, opportunity and motivation. Now, why is suffering wonderful? It's because that's where we really learn things. You don't learn how to be patient unless you're confronted with a situation in which you need to use patience, right? You don't learn how to stay calm unless you're presented with a situation which could make you angry, right? So we tend to think that we want to avoid suffering. No, this philosophy helps you to not avoid suffering, but to learn how to deal with it when it comes up and to transform it into a way to give you a peaceful mind and heart. So precious human rebirth is a result of past ethical behavior, and it's important to practice ethics in this life to create the cause for perfect human rebirth in future lives. We were not born with claws and a requirement to kill to survive, like animals, like many animals. And whether we believe that animals have emotion and reason, there's no question that humans have a great capacity for using their minds as excellent tools for achieving a peaceful, happy life for themselves and others. Our resident teacher, Geshe Gelug, says that he and other Tibetans just really can't understand why so many Westerners do not value their lives. He was amazed to see many depressed elders when he went to see a friend in a nursing home. He said in Tibet, even the elderly, you never find a depressed person because they feel like the infirmities of old age, leave them free to dedicate their time to praying for others. And that was an eye-opener for me, because I've worked in many nursing homes and hospitals and saw a lot of really depressed people saying, I'm old and useless. What a different mindset to say, oh, well, now I'm old and I can't work. That leaves me time free to dedicate my thoughts and prayers to others. Isn't that a wonderful way to be? And we can all achieve that. We ask so many times, what is the meaning of life? Westerners are always saying, what is the meaning of life? Well, the Buddhists would say, that's an unanswerable question. What is the meaning of life? What we would say is, it's up to us to infuse our life with meaning. That's what we should be doing. Instead of just going, oh, what's the meaning? What's the meaning? Stop wasting your energy with that and start putting meaning into it. We can all do that. Some years ago, I went down to Atlanta. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, I think just about every year, has this collaboration of Buddhists and scientists, and they'll take a topic. And it's very important to him that anything that is taught in Buddhism is consistent with science. And he says that if science can prove one of the teachings in Buddhism to not be true, then we will stop teaching it. Okay, so it's very important. So that's why he has these conferences every year. And a few years ago, I went down to Atlanta to one. The topic was depression. Big deal in this country, isn't it? And around the world, too. And there were neuroscientists and psychologists and psychiatrists and sociology people and all these different people all discussing what depression is, how it can be resolved. And it's very interesting. One of the things that I heard there is that depressed people have in common these symptoms. One, a feeling of worthlessness, that their life doesn't matter. Two, a feeling that their current state of misery will not end. Three, they have a feeling of isolation and disconnection from others. What's interesting is that in Buddhism, even from the very beginning, some of the ideals that are really emphasized are, first, that we have a most precious human life. Two, impermanence. Nothing stays the same. Everything changes continually. And third, the idea of interdependence. Everything is interconnected. Everything. So, right there, it helps us to understand why Geshe-la was so amazed that so many Westerners were depressed. Because the essence of Tibetan Buddhism, or Buddhism in general, are those three things. That we have a precious human life. Unlike the depressed people who think that their life has no meaning, it has no value. And second, we believe that nothing stays the same. Everything is, as soon as it starts, it's beginning to change from moment to moment. So even the worst moments are going to change. And third, in interdependence, that we are all interconnected, and anything that any one of us is or says or does or thinks affects others, and we are affected by everyone that's around us. That's counter to that third quality of depression, of feeling isolated, isn't it? So if you really take each of these concepts one at a time and really think about them and know them to be true for yourself, you can see right there how it might start helping your mind to have more more value and meaning to yourself, and then of course to others as well. There are two little paragraphs or whatever that His Holiness the Dalai Lama has put out or said that I'd like to read to you. One is called The True Meaning of Life. He says, "We are visitors on this planet. We are here for 90 or 100 years at the very most. During that period, we must try to do something good, something useful with our lives. If you contribute to other people's happiness, you will find the true goal, the true meaning of life." Another is called A Precious Human Life. And he says, "Every day, think as you wake up, today I am fortunate to have woken up. I'm alive. I have a precious human life. I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to use all my energies to develop myself, to expand my heart out to others, to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. I'm going to have kind thoughts toward others. I'm not going to get angry or think badly about others. I'm going to benefit others as much as I can." If you can wake up every day and think that, you will find yourself feeling lighter and more peaceful and happy. Any questions? Okay, let's go on to the next. Oh, here's a little cartoon. So the ant, huh? Yes, just, yeah, no problem. It's all right.
It's about the karma topic.
Karma?
I wanted to ask if there's brand new consciousness, is that possible for it to enter the human form, or does it have to start from a lesser species in order to become a human?
You're asking if there's a brand new consciousness, how does that get introduced into the flow of... How does it come into the physical? That's a question I really can't answer, except to say that the non-physical in the physical form support one another during this period that they are together. So they do affect one another, but they're kind of together but separate. And I'm not sure that I could really answer your question in just a few sentences or even really authoritatively answer it very well. You're welcome. Thank you for your question. Okay, so it's just a little cartoon. So the answer to eternal happiness isn't an upgrade. Okay. Buddha's view of death. So, it might sound kind of depressing to think about death, right? And it can be, but it can be a very helpful motivator if you think of it in a positive way. We're encouraged to think about it daily as motivation to live this life to its fullest potential. And I just read those two sayings to you. Now, here is what we know for sure about death. It is certain to happen, and the time of death is uncertain. So we know we are all going to die. Nobody knows when that's going to happen. Right? For example, my parents were killed in an automobile accident. So after it happened, I remember going to the house, and my brother comes in and sees a sweater of my mother's on the chair and said, "They didn't know they weren't coming home." And I thought, you know what? Do any of us know that we're not coming home one day? I mean, we just really don't know. We go about our lives as though we're going to live forever. But it's important to remember that we're not going to. We all think that we're going to know when it's going to be time to happen and that we'll have time to prepare. Most of us will not have that opportunity. So it's really important that you work on your life every single day. Make every single day an effort to be the best day, the best person that you can be. Venerable Rubina says that we hear of people being diagnosed with terminal illness and think, oh, they're dying, without stopping to think that we're all dying. Many healthy people die sooner than those that are dying. Use this to reinforce the value of each moment of life. And here's another thing that Buddhists believe just as surely as the fact that we're all going to die and we don't know when it's going to happen. And what we believe is the state of your mind at the time of death is critical to a good rebirth. Not knowing when that will happen, it's important to work constantly to achieve a peaceful mind. By the way, consistent with all Buddhist philosophy, the process of death, both the physical and mind transition, are predictable and knowable. As you advance in your learning and practice, it may be helpful to review the process. The more you understand, the more control and less fear you will have. And this is not unique to Buddhism. Modern science is supporting it. In 1994, Dr. Sherwin Nuland published How We Die with a goal to demythologize death, demythologize death, making it more familiar and therefore less frightening so the dying might approach decisions regarding their care with greater knowledge and more reasonable expectations. You probably have, or most of you have probably heard of Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. If you've taken any classes about death and dying or philosophy or medical classes, Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was the first person to, not that long ago, maybe in the 70s, to study the dying process. And people, she would work with people who were dying, okay, who were terminally ill, and talk to them about how it felt, how this process felt, and came with the stages of dying, the denial, the anger, the acceptance, you know, and all those stages. And so nobody really studied this before or even thought it was a good idea. It was kind of like a taboo, right? But once she started studying the process with people, so many people just picked up on it because they want to understand. When you know what's going on, you feel more comfortable, more in control. And as you advance in the Buddhist philosophy, there is a lot of information about this dying process that you can become familiar with. But it's like trying to do physics before you've done basic math, right? You start with the simpler ideas. Don't try to start with a concept like advanced karma or the stages of death before you are very familiar with the basic terminology and the basic ideas, because it will just confuse you and make you feel more anxious. But I just want to let you know that that is part of the continuum of Buddhist philosophy. The 10 non-virtuous actions. Now, we did talk about this a little in previous classes. What does this remind you of when we see a list of 10 non-virtuous actions? Do you kind of think the 10 commandments? Right? So, there is a similarity in that it's a guide for what ethical behavior is, but it is deliberately not a command. You will never find anything in the Buddhist philosophy that says you must do this, you must believe that. We just say, this is the law. If you do this, then this is going to happen. You know, it's up to you. If you engage in non-virtuous actions, it produces a negative state of mind, and guess what? Negative produces more negative, right? So if you want to have a positive mind, you try to root out the pollution in the water and remove it. You try to avoid the non-virtuous actions. And of these, the most important one to avoid, the first one is killing. Of course, all of the others are important as well, but that's a very important one. Now, one way of thinking about non-virtuous action is that another word for non-virtuous action is delusion. Okay? The 10 non-virtuous actions are delusions. And I found this very interesting commentary that I want to read to you. You first need to recognize that your mind is always changing. Like we talked about, every thought is producing another one and another one. You are never stuck in the exact same thought at any time, even if you think you are by repeating the same kind of thought. It's really a new thought every moment, right? It's always changing. So a powerfully negative state of mind, such as hatred, may arise one moment, but it's certain to subside. That's the very nature of things. They change. They don't last. Furthermore, none of these negative, disturbing states of mind rests on a solid foundation. They're all based on misconceptions. In fact, jealousy, hatred, greed, and the like, any of these non-virtuous actions, they lead to suffering and dissatisfaction precisely because they are out of step with reality. They paint a misleading picture of the world. If you happen to find something attractive, the delusion of attachment exaggerates its good qualities until it appears perfect and utterly desirable. Then, if you happen to discover even the slightest flaw in that same object, your anger and disappointment may make the object appear worthless or even repulsive to in your eyes. What a roller coaster ride of emotions. Because the delusions have no firm foundation in reality, they can be overcome by wisdom. Wisdom is the positive, clarifying mental factor that shows you the way things actually are, not the way you falsely imagine them to be. The other positive states of mind and heart, such as love and compassion, are not threatened by wisdom at all. In fact, they're strengthened by it. So we tend to put judgments on things. We exaggerate their positive qualities and want them to, even if it harms ourselves or others. Or we exaggerate the negative qualities and try to avoid things or try to harm them, when the actual reality of things just are. If this thing happened, it's because we did or thought something that brought us to it. Or causes and conditions. Everything happens as a result of causes and conditions. So just think about it in that way, and it helps you move away from these extremes of attachment and aversion. and helps you acquire more equanimity, which is really an important component of having a peaceful mind and heart, and to be able to develop love and compassion for yourself and others. Now, in terms of these non-virtuous actions, you know, there are degrees of these, right? Like, killing an insect is certainly not as heavy as killing a human being, right? So, the whole idea of karma is a huge and complex chapter, books. I mean, it's a huge concept, right? And we're just barely touching the very tip of it, okay? So it's important that you remember that. And I'm sure you all have confusing questions in your mind about what karma is and all, because we're just touching it here in this class, okay? But it's important to remember that intention or motivation and effort are very important and meaningful and affect how heavy the karmic imprint is. Venerable Verbena tells of a story that she did a lot of work in the prisons. And she was working with this prisoner who was a notorious gang leader and was responsible for the demise of many other people. And one day he said to her, after listening to her talk, he said, "Well, you know, I went back to my cell and my cellmate really upset me and I put his head in the toilet, but Rabina, I pulled it back out." So that was a little effort on his part, right? That was a step in the right direction. So it just shows you that, you know, we're not all going to instantly, just because we want to be calm and happy and peaceful, it's not going to happen overnight. It requires effort and time and repetition, okay? So be kind to yourself. Don't beat yourself up if you can't be perfect in the next day. If anybody learns how to be perfect in a day, write a book, let us know how you did it, and we'll happily give you whatever you want for it. Okay, next. So, there are only two ways to change the course of karma, okay? This does that, and that, and that, and that. There's two ways to interrupt it. One is if you have a lot of good stuff built up and you have a moment of anger. Anger can blow a big piece of your good stuff. Why? Because when you get angry, it just consumes your whole brain. It pushes all the good stuff out. And it takes a lot of effort to blow that big wad of anger out and come back to your good place, doesn't it? So, it's very important to think about what are the things that cause anger to arise in you and walk it backward. What was the very beginning emotion that led you down that path of anger? Think about it, study yourself, and try to interrupt yourself back and back and back and back till you can interrupt that very first moment that leads you down the path of anger. The other is if you created some negative karma, had a lot of negative actions, thoughts, and you want to change that, purification is the way to do that. Most religions have something comparable, a confession and different things. But the way it works in Buddhism, purification is called the four opponent powers. Okay, so regret, it's not guilt. Regret is different from guilt. Guilt is a useless emotion. It says, I did something bad, I can't undo it, I'm a bad person, and it just keeps you stuck. Regret means to recognize and accept that you did something less than desirable and say, I did that thing. I accept that I did it. What can I do to undo it? So the second thing, reliance, in the case of Buddhism, it's basically a reliance on the laws of karma. Okay? You may choose a different philosophy or way of thinking about a reliance, a system of working this out. But whatever you do, don't mix and match. Choose one way. If you start using a little bit of Buddhism and a little bit of Christianity and a little bit of something else, you're just going to get confused. Choose the path that seems to be feel most comfortable to you and be consistent with that. If you find that it works for you, then stay with that. If it's not working for you, then try another route. But mixing and matching terminology and ideas would just cause confusion. So in the case of Buddhism, we would think of this in the way of how did karma bring me to this, and how can I use that to make a change? So in Buddhism, it's really thinking about cause and effect, how positive produce positive, negative produce negative. So that's what we would think. And then, of course, third, remedy. What can I do to make up for this? If I hurt somebody, is there something that I can do to remedy the harm that I've done? If there is, then do that. There may not be anything you can do to fix it, but at least make that effort and that intention. And then fourth, of course, resolve not to do that again. Okay. Now we're going to review some important terms and concepts in Buddhism. Now this is going to be a quick review and very, very surface, okay? As many of you are new to this class, this Buddhism in a Nutshell is trying to cover all of Buddhism in 5 quick classes, okay? There's the next step, of courses is called Discovering Buddhism on Monday nights, and they'll take any one of these topics like karma or the mind or this and take that one topic for 5 weeks. And that's just a very introductory class. So you see, this is really just very surface. But these are words that you will hear often if you're reading about or listening about Buddhist philosophy. So I just want to introduce you to these terms. Some of them we've already heard. But interdependence, okay, is nothing and no sentient being can exist independent of others. Even if you're living on a rock in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, the fact that other people breathe oxygen or, you know, breathe air and used water and, you know, affected the climate, it's going to affect you. But most of us in this everyday world, the clothes that we wear, the food that we eat, the buildings that we are in, everything that is made. You know, you choose even a shirt, okay? Well, imagine all the people that were involved in just the shirt that you're wearing. You know, the store that you bought it at, the people who were working in the store and are there to sell it to you, who made the shirt and who grew the cotton and who made the machines that wove the cloth. I mean, on and on and on and on and on. And you take that for every single thing in your life. You can see how none of us can exist without all of us. Impermanence. The moment things and events come into existence, their disintegration has already begun. That can sound a little depressing, but if you think of it, in terms of nothing, even the bad times will change. So will the good times. So it's up to us to keep creating positive, right? Because no matter how negative things have been for us, it's always changing, and we have control over the direction that it goes. Dependent arising. Self and things come into existence in dependence on causes and conditions, their parts, and the mind labeling them. That's a tough one to try and have you explain to you in just these few moments. But basically it means that this shirt arose because the causes and conditions, everything came together. All the machinery, the fields that had the seed that grew the cotton and the farmer that farmed it and harvested it and brought it into the factory. You know, there's all these causes and conditions. There's never just one thing. So we do have control over the direction of our lives, but we also need to recognize that we are working with causes and conditions around us. So we can work, do our best, make our best effort to direct our positive thoughts, energies forward, and to recognize that there are conditions around that will affect how our next thoughts and actions will be. But then in turn, we remember that we are interdependent. So what we are putting out is going to affect what is around us. What's around us also affects us. So it might not be as straightforward, simple, and direct as you would like it to be. You know, we would like to think, oh, if we're really positive, tomorrow's just going to be a great day, and the day after that's going to be even greater, okay? We have to recognize that there are causes and conditions around us and within us, and they all work together. So it's slow going, possibly, but don't give up. And keep that in your mind. I hope I didn't confuse you. Okay, other important terms and concepts. Love, loving kindness. The wish that all sentient beings be happy. Okay, so this is the definition of love. The definition of love is that we wish that all sentient beings be happy and have the causes of happiness. Compassion is the wish that all sentient beings are free from suffering and the causes of suffering. And equanimity is having the above wishes for all sentient beings equally, from your best friend to your worst enemy. You just recognize that no one wants to suffer, and that everyone wants to be happy. And when you can really understand and accept that and see that, in spite of no matter what anybody says or does, you have achieved equanimity. On a side note, one of the things that really attracted me personally to Buddhism is that, you know, I was raised in the Roman Catholic tradition and just found that I couldn't find answers to questions that I had and tried a lot of different things. But in all the different religions and philosophies that I kind of tested out, what I found, as you all might think, is that they all really emphasize that golden rule, you know, be good to others, be kind to others, have love and compassion for others. They would all say that, and they would maybe have some examples of some holy beings who acted with love and compassion, but none of them could define, well, what is love? You know, love your neighbor, love one another. Well, what does that mean, love? I mean, there's a bazillion ways to think about what love is. And so how am I supposed to love somebody that I don't know or, you know, think is not behaving very well? So the definition of the first day that I came to a Buddhist teaching, it was this, the four immeasurables, which is what these definitions come from. The first sentence is, may all being sentient beings be happy and have the causes of happiness. And that is the definition of love. Well, now that I know that love means I'm going to wish that others be happy, it helped me to know more how to do it. So when I was told to love my neighbor or my brother or the person in the news, now I know what it means is I should wish for them to be happy. And it just kind of helped my mind to know what that definition was. And the same with compassion, how so many people would, and I would use the words interchangeably, love and compassion, but they're really a little different. Wishing that someone be free from suffering is a little different than wishing that they be happy. It's just a little bit different, but it's really helpful to understand that. And then you want to say, well, and this is what you would do when you're studying, think, well, the wish that all beings be happy, well, what does that mean? What does happy mean? Well, happy means freedom from negative thoughts. Well, what are negative thoughts? Well, the 10 non-virtuous actions. Well, what are they? You know, and you go on, and then, you know, you just really think about each thing, and like, what does it mean? How can I do that? How can I avoid that? Okay? Okay. Another important term or concept in Buddhism is the three principal aspects of the path. Okay, these are three basic concepts in Buddhism. One is renunciation. It's a heartfelt wish to be free from the sufferings of cyclic existence. So if you decide that this is a philosophy that feels comfortable to you and is helpful to your mind, you will probably want to engage in it because you recognize that you have not felt in control of your mind and your heart and your life. And you're tired of this happening over and over again. And you want to be free from the suffering. And so you renounce the uncontrolled cyclic cycle of uncontrolled life. And I'm sorry that will sound confusing to you. It's something we discuss in another class called samsara, you know, but that's what that is. Bodhicitta, and the bodhisattva is a person who has bodhicitta. It's an altruistic intention to become enlightened for the sake of helping all others to become so. So having this altruistic attitude is very important in our branch of Buddhism. And the other important concept is that of emptiness or right view. And this really is a term that, without having a background in Buddhism, might be a little hard to understand, but you're going to hear it a lot. And empty does not mean vacant or nihilism, that nothing exists. Okay. This emptiness is also known as the wisdom of emptiness, and it's the absence of all false ideas about how things exist, specifically the lack of apparent independent self-existence of phenomena. It is not nihilism, which means that nothing truly exists. It's just that anything made up of components does not exist on its own. It exists as labeled by our mind. Remember interdependence and dependent arising. Now, boy, that's a brainful, isn't it? So maybe an illustration might be, somebody showed me this and I found it to be helpful. Okay, so this is a flower, right? When did it start being a flower? Now we call it flower, this collection of petals with a little leaf, something that grows from seed. We call it a flower. But when did it start being flower? Was it a flower when it was in the seed? What is it? Was it a flower when it was in the sprout? Or did it just start being flower when it was a bud? Or only when it opened up? And if we pull away the petals, when does it stop being flower? So this hopefully is illustrating to you that this is made up, this is something that is made up of component parts that exists as flower because we see these component parts together and label it flower. Another way of thinking about it might be to think about self. Now we think of ourself as, you know, what we see when we look in the mirror, what we see when we look down. Well, what if you lost both your arms? Would you still be yourself? What if you lost all your limbs? What if you had a head injury and your mind was thought in a very different way? Would you still be yourself? Or when you say, I'm really proud of myself, or I'm so ashamed of myself, who's the self that's thinking, I'm proud of myself, or I'm ashamed of myself? So self is really a collection of the mind, the non-physical and the physical that are somehow together, but really kind of separate. It's something that's together that we label self. So this is really some thought to be pondered on, again, after you have really taken it slow and started with some of the basic thoughts, because it can really blow your brain, right? But again, I wanted to introduce to you that emptiness, when you're talking about emptiness in Buddhism, you are not talking about nothing. Okay? You are talking about how things truly exist. And I hope you don't have any questions about this one, because I don't know if I could answer them. It's a tough one. Okay. All right. So, next. Oh, here's just a little cartoon. There's nothing on. Excellent. Let's watch that. So, that's not what emptiness means. Okay. Now, I just wanted to talk to you about that we have a very special opportunity happening at the Gadampa Center this week. Starting on Thursday through Sunday, Geshe Sangpo is going to be creating a green Tara sand mandala here at the Gadampa Center. It's going to start on Thursday. The opening ceremony is going to be at 9 o'clock. You can come and watch him working on it Thursday, Friday, Saturday, 9 to 5. And on Sunday from, I think, 9 to noon. It's in the, it's on our website, the hours. And then on Sunday, I think at 2, please check the website for the correct time, there's the closing ceremony. Now, has anybody in here ever seen a sand mandala? You have, a few of you have. They are amazing. It's a meditational tool that, it's, I really, If you go to our website or Google San Mandala, you can get these little videos that are fast composite. Yes? Oh, wonderful. On House of Cards, of all places. Oh, my goodness. Well, it's literally a drawing that's made out of colored sand. And the whole process is an intense ritual and meditation on the part of the monks from the very beginning, where they literally take blocks of marble, stone, and take a hammer and pound it and crush 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 it more and more and more until it's ground down to sand that is fine enough to be sifted through cloth. Okay? A lot of work. And that's to symbolize, very simply, to symbolize that what you see, a rock, you think of a rock, if anything is permanent and unchanging, it's a rock, right? Well, that just shows you that it, like everything else, is made up of parts that you can break down. And then that sand, once it's sifted, they color the sand. So what once was just sand now takes on the representation of each color represents a different aspect or quality, a healing, energy, wisdom, and different things. So the sand now becomes a representation of a quality. So then they take the sand and they have a table with this. Everybody knows what a mandala is, right? It's a design, a very symmetric, complex design. And they create this design by using these tools called a chukpa. It's a long silver metal cone. They're about this long. Very narrow at one end and wider up to like an inch or so at the other end. Put the sand through there and by tapping it, make these complex designs. So the meditation continues as they're putting down the design. They're thinking of what the color represents, the energy, and the representation that they're drawing, whether it's a lotus or something else. It's they're thinking about the energy behind that. And to our eyes, it appears to be a two-dimensional flat sand painting. But as they're creating it, they're actually creating a three-dimensional model of a palace. And in the center, the green Tara is the female Buddha of compassion. Okay, there's very briefly, the Buddhas here each represent a quality or characteristic that we aspire to. Like the blue one is the medicine Buddha. So we aspire to healing and compassion and peace. Okay, when we look at that. This is from the days when they didn't have written language or a lot of literate people. Okay. But it's also still uses a meditational prompt. Okay, so they're not gods that we worship. They are a representation of qualities. And then the female aspects, the Taras, very generally, are those qualities in action. So the green Tara is a quality of compassion in action. So you don't know how to express compassion in action until you know what compassion means. And knowing what compassion means without putting it in action doesn't have all that much value, right? So that's why they're very important to work together. But this sand mandala, the green Tara, is a meditation on compassion in action. So they'll put either a lotus or maybe a green Tara in the center that represents compassion. And having that in the center means compassion starts with us. We're in the middle, okay? But at the, But it also means that because it's in the middle, we have to go through this what looks like two-dimension but is actually a palace, go through the doors and make our way through different intentions and actions and efforts to get to that middle. And so anyway, that's basically what a thin mandala is about. And it is said that all the energy that the monks are putting into this, all this positive energy, just by seeing it, being around it, you will be positively affected by it. And this is really a very precious opportunity. So if you have a chance any time between Thursday and Sunday to come and see this, I really encourage you to do that. At the closing ceremony on Sunday afternoon, you will see, after all of this amazing work, and boy, it's, when you watch them doing it, you think, oh my gosh, how can I do that? And you can actually have an opportunity to try it out yourself to see how difficult it really is. So they created this amazing complex, hours and hours and hours and hours of work. Then at the closing ceremony, they dedicate their efforts and they destroy it. It's really painful to watch. But the importance of that is that everything is impermanent. Nothing stays the same. So they'll destroy it and sweep it up, and they'll take part of the sand and carry it to a body of water and put it back so that it will go back, float down, bring its energy in the water to all the sentient beings around the earth, and then maybe someday go back to being a rock again. And so, but then, and one way that you, if you choose to share in the blessings of this meditational effort, they will be giving out little bits of that sand in a little bag that you can take with you if that helps your mind to bring a little piece of this representation of this blessing home with you to keep. So I just wanted to let you know all of that. And next week is our last class of the five, and we're going to review some of the key concepts and if you have any questions about anything that's going on. And I put together a collection of some basic important Buddhist prayers and excerpts and quotes that you can use for your own meditation and self-help. One of the prayers actually helped walk you through the basic concepts of Buddhism that help you, like this interdependence and the meaning of life, and you know it's the graduated path, okay, of trying to help your mind. And others are just things that I have found to be very, very helpful when things got tough or I was having a hard time with my mind, and that I will share those things with you. Now, we will dedicate our efforts tonight. I appreciate everybody taking the time, the effort, and the energy to come here, whether it's the first or last or the only class that you've attended. You've all come here with something in your mind that you were hoping to get, and I dedicate this teaching to the hope that you all have received at least a little something that has helped you tonight, and that you will take that and use it to help others. And, you know, everything that we do here at the Gaudapa Center, there's no charge for anything. And remember that all of this is here out of the generosity of people that have come before. So if you feel like you've gotten anything from tonight, if you have some gratitude for the fact that the center was here for you tonight, and if you have anything that you can contribute to help this, whether it's time or a dollar or whatever, we very much appreciate anything that you can do to help support us. Okay, and that is it for tonight. Thank you all for your attention. Have a safe journey home.